tonight on Arena. We remember the force of nature that was Marianne Faithfull, and Hard Truths, Blue Road and Saturday Night are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The death of singer and actress Marianne Faithfull has been announced. She was 78. Faithfull's hits included As Tears Go By, which was written by the Rolling Stones' Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, The Ballad of Lucy Jordan, which featured in Thelma and Louise, and Broken English. In addition to her music career, Marianne Faithfull also acted in films including The Girl on a Motorcycle, as well as several theatre productions. A statement said, "It is with deep sadness that we announce the death of singer, songwriter and actress Marianne Faithfull. She passed away peacefully in London today in the company of her loving family." And Dave Fanning joins me now to talk a little bit more about Marianne Faithfull. She really was, Dave, in that early part of the 60s and her own records that she made at that time, she made an enormous splash in terms of singer-songwriter at that time.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of swinging in London, she was almost the female face of it. I mean, Dusty Springfield had so many hits between 63 and 66, but she wasn't necessarily as swinging London as Marianne was. Marianne was just a girl who went to a party one day with Andrew Lou Goldham, who was the manager of the Stones, and John Dunbar, who she later married. And like, the connections are just insane. She married John Dunbar, whose best man at the wedding with the two of them was Peter Asher. Peter Asher was Jane Asher's brother, who's John Paul McCartney's girlfriend. Peter was Peter and Gordon of this band as well. And they all had hit singles and they all sort of hit the charts. Her one hit the charts big time, As Tears Go By, was absolutely huge. And the Stones recorded that themselves later, and that was successful also. But the thing is that, like, you know, she was most famous for, whether you like it or not, being the girlfriend of Mick Jagger. And yeah, that was the most important thing of all.
Well, it certainly came in the 1970s. But in terms of As Tears Go By, and you say that in the midst of that group of people and all of those connections, this song really stood out. Why did it stand out? What made it so much better than the others that were there?
Things stand out because of the push they sometimes get. I mean, if you're going to be associated with the Stones and the Beatles and all of that part of swinging London, then, you know, there's a very good chance that your song might get played on the radio. And also, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards wrote the song, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why it would do so well, you know? But, I mean, it was a fine song. It was great. It was whatever it was. But she seemed to be kind of innocent in the whole thing. And then, you know, like, when there was a drug bust at the Stones place and she was, like, the tabloids had a field day because she was dressed only in a robe. She said she never lived that down. It just sounded really bad and awful. And then the 1970s came, and the 1970s were, I mean, you wouldn't believe how bad the story was.
Well, everything went astray at that time for lots of people, let's be honest. But let us listen to that moment of huge glory that where she really did break through in terms of the charts and in terms of music, and the song As Tears Go By.
Children play.
have all of it. I thought she deserved at least that, the 2 minutes and 35 seconds that is As Tears Go By from Marianne Faithfull, the song certainly that launched her career in many ways. Dave Fanning with us talking about Marianne Faithfull this evening, whose death was announced earlier today. She was 78. And as you were saying, Dave, you know, yet then there's all that period of the 70s when it's a lot of it is, yeah, tabloid fodder and newspaper and photograph fodder and television fodder at the time. But she recovered from that.
Yeah, but hold on, that's not strictly true, because that was really more of the 60s. And like, you know, there's plenty, like, I mean, the Stones released an album in 66 called Aftermath, which I thought was a bit overrated and not great. And on that album, there's stuff like Lady Jane and Lady Anne, and they sing about Hampstead and nice places in London. She was part of a sort of a rich aristocracy in terms of her mother on Eastern Europe on that side, and her father was a professor of literature. And she was part of something, like, as I mentioned, John Dunbar, who she married. John Dunbar was the guy who introduced John to Yoko in his Indica gallery. It was all really kind of cool and all really happening in that. But when the 70s came, and you mentioned earlier on, well, a lot of people had a bad 70s. I mean, nobody had a 70s like Marianne Faithfull. Yeah, I mean, she literally lived in the gutters of Soho for 3 full years. She lived on the street. The heroin, the drugs, they completely ruined her. And a really strange thing happened in that you heard her voice just on that track there.
So innocent and clear. Yeah.
Yeah. When she made a comeback in 1979, slightly when punk was still happening and could therefore be seen to be kind of, you know, have something to say and all that, she released an album called Broken English. And the song Broken English is just fantastic. But the really weird thing is her voice is completely shot. It makes the song 10 times better, I hate to say. She also released about 10, 20 more albums. She was at the Chieftains. She did loads. I don't know the albums like in the 80s or 90s much. But she released loads of music. And as you said earlier on, she's really famous for being on so many stages around the world in plays. And she did about 7 or 8 movies as well.
Yeah, I mean, I know she was in performed here in Ireland, certainly.
Yeah, big time.
And in the Threepenny Opera at the Gate, if my memory is serving me correctly.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
You know, and she was perfect for that kind of Brechtian set, because that new voice that had come out of the difficult period had that kind of a rawness and a lived-in quality to
exactly.
it. That, you know, I mean, she obviously had this substance within her, but suddenly this voice gave expression to that.
Exactly. And she also even went one step further and brought out a full album of Kurt Vile music and has done the Threepenny Opera in various places, you know, around the world. And a lot more to do with Kurt Vile. And, you know, but the point about it is that, like, some of the songs, just to get back a tiny bit on the Rolling Stones' best albums, like we're on Sticky Fingers and that, like Wild Horses, I Got the Blues, You Can't Always Get What You Want. They're all about Marianne Faithfull, most likely. In fact, one of the songs, Sister Morphine, is co-written by Jagger Richards and Marianne Faithfull.
She gets the credit on that as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned Broken English there, and as we were listening to As Tears Go By as well, text came in from Stephen Greystones. So sad that Marianne Faithfull has passed. She transformed Shel Silverstein's Ballad of Lucy Jordan into a stone-cold classic.
Yeah, that was the big one for Ireland. Absolutely huge. In fact, she had a number one album in Ireland, which was a country music album.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, let's have listened to a little bit of Ballad of Lucy Jordan and hear that new voice that you'd been speaking about, Dave.
Memorized, my daddy's knees.
was off to work. We have a little bit of the Ballad of Lucy Jordan from Marianne Faithfull. And Dave Fanning, you know, you really, you hear the country ability within all of that, despite that kind of dubious organ accompaniment in underneath it. The country ability is there, but we don't get, you know, the later voice, the very late voice of Marianne Faithfull, which had that wonderful lived-in quality to it.
Well, I mean, the other thing about it is also, I mean, one of the things that happened to her most recently, like she had a back injury about 10 years ago. She broke her hip in Greece on holidays. She was very badly hit by COVID when that happened as well.
Yeah.
And she was trying to get back with major breathing lessons recently and was doing quite well, it seems, even though she called off loads of gigs. But her Irish connections down through these years go from, you know, Frank McGuinness, she did stuff with him. And also she's on the Chieftains album in 1995, The Long Black Veil. And like, obviously, Nick Cave and PJ Harvey, people know about that and that album as well. But, you know, it's like she was part of that whole British invasion thing, which I know people say, oh, that was the Beatles and then the Stones. It was really like Dave Clark Five and Herman's Hermits and people like, well, I'm obviously after the Beatles, but it's, and people like Marianne Faithfull.
Yeah, and she definitely, in terms of the female artists, I think Marianne Faithfull was at the very top end of that.
No question.
British invasion. Thanks for speaking to us about her this evening. But you mentioned we mentioned the COVID thing there, Dave, and I'm going to finish up, in fact, because back with something relating to that, back in May of 2021, she spoke with me here in Arena about an album she had just released at the time, inspired by her love of the Romantic Poets, all about that breathing that you were talking about and the delivery of poems like that. The album was called She Walks in Beauty, and it featured Marianne reciting the poems, backed by musical soundscape created by Warren Ellis, no less. Again, linking into what you said, Dave. She'd only recently recovered from a very serious case of COVID and was very hopeful, as you will hear, about the future.
I've been pretty much struck down. I will get better, apparently, my doctor says. I don't smoke anymore. I don't drink or take drugs. I can't do anything like that. I really have to look after myself now. And I think I'll be all right. But, yeah, I won't, definitely won't be able to go a roving, as it were.
Well, listen, Marianne, don't give up on the roving just yet for all of us. Promise me that, at least.
I can't promise, but I'll try.
Give it a go. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Marianne.
Thanks, darling.
And let's finish up then with So We'll Go No More A Roving, from the new album from Marianne Faithfull, She Walks in Beauty.
So we'll go no more a-roving, so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, we will go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
Voice of Marianne Faithfull there as she spoke to me back in 2021 from the album She Walks in Beauty. Beautiful recitations of several romantic poems that she gives within that. And some lovely responses from our listeners. Met Marianne many times as she lived in part of Carlton House in Maynooth for many years. Lovely lady, says John. And Marianne played the Temperance Hall in Loughrea when I was in my early 20s. It was a country night, and the locals didn't know what to make of her. Hilarious, says Ger. Well, she's off a roving now, wherever we all go a roving when things end here. May she rest in peace. We've been celebrating Marianne Faithfull, whose death was announced today at the age of 78. Tonight on Arena's Film Reviews, a giant of Irish literature, a giant of British independent cinema, and a giant of American comedy. Filmmaker Sinead O'Shea brings us a new feature-length documentary on the novelist and writer Edna O'Brien, who died last year. In Hard Truths, writer-director Mike Lee reunites with actor Marianne Jean-Baptiste to bring us the story of Pansy, a tragically difficult woman who cannot help but alienate everyone around her. And as SNL turns 50 this year, new film Saturday Night brings us through the origin of the legendary sketch show as producer Lorne Michael gets the very first Saturday Night Live up on air. But first this evening, Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story. In July of last year, writer Edna O'Brien died. Her burial in the Holy Island in Lough Derg was a dramatic and moving end to a literary life that was lyrical, challenging and brave. Sinead O'Shea's new documentary, Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story, is based on a series of interviews done with the author during her exploring her life and work, as well as narration from her diaries, from Edna O'Brien's diaries by Jesse Buckley. Let us say, Hilary Fanning is not with me in studio. Hilary White is with me in studio.
We're easily confused.
Yeah, all the time, I'm sure it happens. First, and Cara O'Doherty is joining us as well down the line. Hilary, the title of the documentary, The Blue Road, refers to County Clare, the source of Edna O'Brien's imagination, her talent. She always had a great love. Anytime I spoke with her, she would talk. The eyes were almost mist up when she talked about County Clare. But it wasn't necessarily an easy place for her.
No, and there is quite a bit of blueness in this profile of this great literary powerhouse that we're talking about. I think that the Blue Road itself was actually something that she saw. It was a description that she had in that her first husband, Ernesto Gebler, he contradicted her on it. But there is a lot of blueness in the story. It is very sad. We have these very compelling interviews with her, very much in the winter of her years, that Sinead O'Shea managed to secure. And while there is this incredible life, this very colourful and storied life, there is also quite a lot of pain in her. You can see the way that she was treated by her home country, the pain and sadness of her upbringing. She had a very, very violent and alcoholic father who gambled away all the family money, a very devout Catholic mother, who very much didn't approve of the type of literature that she was writing. And it's tragic just how that's still with her at the age of 93.
Well, I suppose, you know, what happens in the early years doesn't go, it Absolutely. Doesn't go away.
Yeah.
And from her very first novel, Cara, The Country Girls, the story of friends Kate and Baba and their passions, she scandalised the establishment, particularly the church, and I'm sure her mother, quite definitely her mother, who was part of the getting rid of the books, as they were told to do. What were they afraid of, if that's not too much of a leading question?
I mean, they were afraid of a woman who knew her own mind and was quite willing and open to speak about, God forbid, sex and women and passion. And I mean, you're talking about a time where even kissing somebody in public would have caused some people to start blushing, let alone talk about what went on between the sheets, which she did boldly and bravely. And it's sparked such significant controversy from her own mother to the Catholic Church, talking in government about this. But it did not stop her in any way. And she continued to do this. And there are countless clips of her on TV shows being interviewed where she was open, she was frank, and she was fearless. She did not back down, and quite boldly and very bravely for the time openly said that, you know, God, women, you know, they had sex. It was a thing they did. Yeah. And you know what? Some of them even enjoyed it. And I mean, this was really something that absolutely scandalized the nation.
I do remember in more recent years, as a mature student studying Irish literature with a bundle of much younger students. And when it came to Edna O'Brien and the Country Girls, they were kind of saying, well, what's so peculiar that they were talking about this? And I remember, You have to think about when it was written and what was it you were allowed to speak
Absolutely.
About then.
We're in the era of Sally Rooney, but she was doing this 50 years ago, where it could make you a pariah in this country.
Absolutely. The form of the film itself, it's quite interesting. Just explain the mix of the two ways we hear Edna O'Brien's voice, Hilary.
So we have her interviewed in the flesh, her final interviews that she did, and there's a gap that comes when she has a downturn in her health and she has to get care, and then the interview is picked back up afterwards after she gets treatment. But she's a very compelling interviewee. Every word is painstakingly chosen. There are silences where you can see that she's just turning something over in her mind. And then at the same time, she is directing Sinead O'Shea to her personal diaries and journals. And she knows the very telling extracts that Sinead should have a look at, and she directs her there, and we see them, and we also see, very tellingly, these annotations and notes in the margin done by Ernest Gebler.
So we're looking at the diaries and the, in inverted commas, corrections, annotations, whatever, by Ernest Gebler. I'll come back to the Ernest Gebler situation.
And the diary extracts are also read by Jesse Buckley.
Yes, Jesse. Yeah, Jesse Buckley reads the diaries. I'll come back to the Ernest Gebler story in a minute, but I want to listen to the voice of Edna herself. Here she is talking, commenting on the question of influence. This is a very young Edna O'Brien.
Ireland, you describe as a country which has been ravaged. Isn't there some peculiar way in which you yourself are doing the same thing? I mean, aren't you...
Stealing from
it? Yes.
Yes, I knew you would ask me that.
Why did you know I would ask
that? But I felt it. I felt it in the air coming. I have to defend myself. I don't think I do.
I'm not attacking you.
No,
I'm I'm trying to make a statement about
it. It is true. I take from the fund of history and geography and stories, and I make of it, or would like to make out of it, my own song. It is a form of stealing, but it's like a bank loan. You have to give it back.
Great way of putting it. Edna O'Brien there in a scene. So that's an archive interview of Edna O'Brien.
There's a fantastic array of archive footage that she's able to find for this.
Let's touch on the Ernest Gebler part of the story then. Hilary mentioning to us, Cara, about how her journals are annotated, and I'm guessing corrected by him. It was a difficult marriage, to say the very least. And a lot of it, certainly from Edna O'Brien's side, was put down to his absolute jealousy of her success.
Yeah, I mean, he was a writer too, and he didn't achieve anywhere near her success or her skill. And this was not something that he could cope with. From early on in their marriage, her success caused problems. But even when they were apart, it didn't stop. I mean, the animosity remained there. But in the diaries, it's quite shocking. He's gone into them and almost like a school teacher. He's written over things and his corrections and places where he comments that was his idea, and she, you know, that they're no more his idea than the man in the moon.
To go into somebody's journals or diaries and even read them is already such an invasion of privacy.
I mean, absolutely. To even think of doing something like that, it just really says it all.
I think he peddled the myth that he wrote those books as well. I think that was something he put out into the ether that was there.
Yeah, his sons,
Sasha and
Carlo, do appear. Do they address anything to do with any of that side?
They identify the handwriting in the margins of these journals.
So they're not saying it wasn't him.
Absolutely, and they allude to what was a very unhappy marriage and a very unhappy domestic situation.
Let's have a listen to maybe when things weren't quite so unhappy. This is the voice of Jesse Buckley, who reads Edna's own description of her meeting Ernest Gebler.
There was Ernest Gebler, handsome beyond words, sallow-faced with dark brown eyes and granite features. He spoke of his trips to Hollywood, of which he was scathing. He was so cosmopolitan and so cultured. He spoke of James Joyce with a familiarity and referred to Leopold Bloom as Paldy. I was elated.
So they both adore Joyce. Who could not? My father wrote a documentary novel about the voyage of the Mayflower, and a sufficient number must have read the book for Hollywood to decide to buy it and to employ Spencer Tracy. My father was the single most ambitious, the one who really wanted to go to the stars.
There you go. That is, in fact, at the very end of that, the voice of Carlo Gabler, the son of Ernest Gabler and Edna O'Brien. What I find interesting is, in terms of how the two might sit together, Hilary, you get archival footage of Edna O'Brien and quite recent stuff, I think, as well.
Yeah.
And then you have juxtaposed with that, quite a task for Jesse Buckley then, to read from those diaries in a realistic fashion and not to attempt to impersonate.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, I mean, the diaries are very telling in the sense that, you know, for a time she stopped writing and her diaries were her way to actually still exercise that need to write. You know, she was in a relationship with a British politician who remains nameless, and that relationship kind of derailed her productivity financially, kind of took its toll, and also took its toll on her health. And journal writing was something that became very important to her. And even very later in life, when she wasn't able to write, she was publishing novels up into her 80s, you know. And so when she was no longer able to do that, that became a real strain on her. She no longer had that outlet. So I think it's very nice that they're brought into this story, those personal journals.
We were talking about Marianne Faithfull before the break, Cara, and London and the wildlife of London, or the high society life of London. There was a period when Edna O'Brien's house was the place to be. If you wanted to go to a party where the most important, whatever that means, people were, her house was the place to go.
Absolutely. And the footage is fantastic. And I think especially for anybody who's a film buff, the chance to see, you know, anybody from Sean Connery to Jane Fonda just kind of sitting around in the sitting room, or Paul McCartney in the kitchen. And I'm fascinated by a story of Robert Mitchum, who turned up at a party one night and wooed Edna.
Yeah. I think she told me a bit of that story in an interview once.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead,
Cara. It's just fantastic to see this footage and just to see. And it's almost funny because she's quite laid back in the middle of all of this. It's just that she was obviously a light that attracted everybody in. And it's just an amazing day. So it would be fabulous to have been a fly on one of those party walls.
But it's really important in the midst of all that fun and frolic not to forget how disciplined a writer she was. You touched on it, Hilary, when you said she was writing through her 80s and into her 90s.
Absolutely. I mean, she, during that swinging 60s period, when she was throwing these lavish parties and there was champagne being popped, she was still putting out almost a novel a year during that time. And I mean, you know, we were talking earlier about how she was sort of derided here and sniffed at here. I mean, she was a literary star in the UK and the US. I mean, that's what put her in proximity with all these film stars and Hollywood actors. And that whole thing of her becoming, if you like, not a party animal, though I think she definitely got a reputation as a party animal. Back in this country, there was this perception, that's just in keeping with the type of content.
Yeah, that explains the books to us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But it doesn't explain the books that she wrote in her later years, which were harrowing tales, various of them.
Absolutely.
And certainly quite difficult in the midst of all that. Does it touch on the Into the Woods story at all? Is that mentioned, that book dealt with?
No, because
it was just the controversy at the time about dealing with real life material, etc. However, that's not gone into clearly in the documentary. Stars on that from you, Hilary, first of all?
It is 4 from me.
4. And what are you saying, Cara O'Doherty?
Absolutely the same, 4 stars. And I just hope that people see this and because, you know, I do think that a lot of people don't really know her well enough here, and hopefully that changes things.
Yep.
Okay, double 4 then for Edna O'Brien. Blue Road, the Edna O'Brien story. Let's move on to Mike Leigh, known for his improvisational approach to filmmaking, of course. He begins with an actor or a group of actors, builds a story from their experiences. And in the case of his new film, Hard Truths, he renewed his relationship with actor Marianne Jean-Baptiste, whom he had worked with on Secrets and Lies, to create a central character who is very discontent, very angry, middle-aged wife and mother of one with the name Pansy. Tell us a little bit more about her, because she sounds like such a difficult character to put at the centre of a film, but that's where she is. Oh, Cara, that's for you. I beg your pardon.
Sorry. Difficult is not the right word for Pansy. I don't think there is enough words to cover quite how challenging and prickly this woman is. She has a ferocious temper. There is nobody who can escape it, not her husband, not her son, not people in shops. She is one of these people. She will stop and shout at somebody in the street if they annoy her in some way, shape or form. She has so many issues, but she is a woman who is living in deep pain, both mental and physical. She can't sleep. She can't get any rest. She has horrendous nightmares. She suffers from chronic pain. There's something in her past that has created this sort of ferocious, terrifying woman. And yet for all of her awful behaviour, her sister, who is played beautifully by Michelle Austin, her sister Chantal, still really cares for her. And it's this really interesting dynamic that even though somebody can be horrible, they still deserve love and understanding and support.
We'll come back to the Pansy and Chantal relationship in a while. But first of all, let's listen to Pansy in full flow. This is just having what you think is a conversation over dinner. Not quite the conversation that you might like to have at home.
A name round the corner with that dog. Got it dressed up in a red coat and green booties. Why's the dog got on a coat? It's got fur, innit? Must be sweating under there, stinking. That's cruelty to animals, that is. Putting it under all that plastic. I've got a mind to report him to the NSPCG or whatever they call them. And her over there with that fat baby. Cold, 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 and she's walking up and down the street with nothing but a big pink bow on its bald head so everybody can tell it's a girl, like I care. Parading it around in the little outfit, not dressed for the weather, nah, with pockets. What's a baby got pockets for? What's it gonna keep in its pocket? A knife? It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
fire-breathing dragon.
She's easily annoyed. Chantal there. Marion Jean-Baptiste playing the character of Pansy, not Chantal, in Mike Lee's Hard Truths. And that's her husband and son are sitting there at the table quietly because they know not to interrupt.
Long-suffering husband and son. And, you know, we were sort of chuckling listening to that clip, and that kind of is what Mike Lee does. I interviewed him many years ago, and he got into filmmaking through a love of vaudeville and absurdist comedy. He loves Flann O'Brien, he was telling me. And you are laughing at this. Just the sheer pitch of her animus is just so, it's so relentless that you can only laugh at it. And then there comes a point where you start to see that this person is actually very damaged and quite traumatised. And there's something really underlying this. I think it's also very telling that this is happening post-COVID as well. So
yes,
there is part of that sort of agoraphobic, shut-in kind of intensity is there as well.
Yeah, Cara mentioned earlier the relationship with her sister Chantal, played by Michelle Austin, which is absolutely key, I think, to the film itself. Let's listen to a scene between the two of them. Chantal is a hairdresser, played by Michelle Austin. So that kind of community of women in a hairdressing shop is important here. And Michelle is at Pansy's house here trying to fix up her sister's hair.
22-year-old man and he's still eating peanut butter and jam sandwiches. I talk to him until I'm tired. I say, Moses, what are you doing with your life? Where do you see yourself in 25 years' time? I'm sick of it.
Do you want me to talk to him?
And say what?
I don't know, just see if I can help him.
What, you trying to insinuate yourself into my family?
Insinuate how?
You wouldn't like it if I talked to your girls like that.
And said what?
Why are you going out exposing your belly to the world? What are you doing dressed up in a squeeze-up, tie-top, yoga pants and you're not even in the gym? You wouldn't like it. You wouldn't like it at all. Some sisters are close, you know. Some sisters confide in each other.
You can confide in me.
Nah, if I don't call you, you don't call me.
I call you.
Nah, I have to call you and say, oh, Chantelle, my hair needs doing. Oh, Chantelle, my back is hurting. Can you pick me up a couple of things from Kilburn?
I call you.
Hey, put down them scissors. You're getting aggressive.
How long would you stay in your sister's house if that was the way you treated her when you went over to help her? By cutting her hair, that is Marianne Jean-Baptiste and Michelle Austin there as the long-suffering sister. You were talking about long-suffering husband earlier on. Mm. Do we get any sense, Hilary here in studio with me, but Cara, do we get any sense that is Chantelle aware of the background that you touched on? That do we get to know the background on the story from the past that causes Pansy to be the way she is?
Her sister certainly knows. Mm. It's clear that they both know exactly what's going on. And there's a tiny hint. On Mother's Day, they go to visit their grave, and there's a couple of comments that are said. So there's a hint that this is obviously from childhood or something that happened then. But the really interesting thing is, I mean, I really want to know what the thing is. But I think that Mike Lee is doing that thing is we often don't know what really is going on behind closed doors and what's going on and what's caused the trauma. And he's replicating real life in this. I mean, it's kind of driving me mad. I want to know her full story. But he's very clever in not sharing her full story.
Yeah, well, I suppose
that's what happens in life.
Yeah, and that is, as you say, true to life. Lots of Oscar buzz. Mike Lee was on with Kay Sheehy earlier in the week. We had it on the programme. Difficult film to get made and accepted at festivals. But there's a bit of Oscar buzz around it now, particularly for Marianne Jean-Baptiste. As you give us stars, Hilary?
I'm going to give this 4 stars. I'm not sure if she's did she get an Oscar nomination? I don't think she did. I think
BAFTA. She didn't get an Oscar nomination,
But certainly for BAFTA, she'd be one to watch.
Yeah. BAFTA nomination.
And it's extraordinary. I mean, this is what Mike Lee does. He gets incredible performances out of his actors. He's a real actor's director and he knows how to get them motoring.
Well, also he gets incredible scripts out of his actors.
Well, yes.
Let's acknowledge their role in that. Absolutely, and he always acknowledges the role of the actor in it as well. So what stars, Hilary?
It is 4 out of 5 for me.
And what are you saying, Cara?
4 out of 5 as well. But for Jean-Baptiste herself, she gets a 5 all by herself.
Just all right.
Playing somebody so angry could become so repetitive on one note, but she brings so many layers. It's remarkable.
Puts her whole body into it. It's
all right.
It's
so four, the double four again, but a 5 for Marianne Jean-Baptiste. Finally then, Saturday Night Live, or SNL as it refers to itself now, celebrating its 50th year. New feature film, Saturday Night, directed by Jason Reitman, brings us back to 1975 and the first ever SNL. And as you would expect, all the big names are there. Chevy Chase, John Belushi, Andy Kaufman and Jim Henson. Just bring us back through what this is. The date is October the 11th, 1975. Cara.
Right. So on this date, a brand new show is about to take off. It's to replace reruns of the much loved The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, which had been a staple of US TV for years. And NBC have commissioned a new show. They're happy for it to be new, to be different, to take a risk. But they're not quite prepared for the reality of SNL. Because the team behind it aren't quite ready for it either. It follows the 90 minutes up to them going on air. And in that 90 minutes, they're still rehearsing. They still haven't figured out costumes. There's actors left, right and centre. And there's lights falling from the ceiling. Because Lorne Michaels, played brilliantly by Gabriel LaBelle, has never worked in TV before.
He was one of the big producers at the time.
Yeah. He knows comedy. He doesn't know TV, but he knows if he can combine the two, he's going to have this really great show. But before that, there is 90 minutes of sheer chaos as he tries to wrangle some of the biggest personalities and egos that are in the comedy world. Yeah. And it's chaos.
And Cara has given part of that to us there when she talks about Lorne Michaels, played by Gabrielle LaBelle. Mm. We see all the characters, but they are being performed by actors because they're all were so much younger 50 years ago,
yes,
obviously.
Absolutely, and very convincingly. I mean, the performances in this film are
So Corey Michael Smith as Chevy Chase.
That's right. Dylan O'Brien, who absolutely nails Dan Aykroyd's voice, and I recognise it as Dan Aykroyd by the voice that he is. Mm. Ella Hunt playing Gilda Radner. Matt Wood as John Belushi. I think Jack Black was obviously sort of 20 years too late too early for this thing. And Cooper Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman's son, is playing Dick Ebersol, who is like sort of the sort of producer, sort of hovering over poor Lorne Michael, trying to midwife this entire crazy jamboree, who Lorne Michael himself can't really quite describe or you know, define very neatly. Willem Dafoe then turns up as this sort of, you know, sort of typically vampiric studio executive who's flown in all the other execs around the country, and they all want to see will this
so
be
pressure,
a calamity.
Pressure is on.
A real sense for pressure cooker with lots of plates spinning.
Okay, let's have a listen to a clip then. 90 minutes to go. Yeah. Lorne Michael, as you say, played by Gabriel Labelle, is chatting with studio executive. This is the Cooper Hoffman character. He's playing Dick Ebersol. Mm. And we'll also hear briefly in this clip Nicholas Brown as Andy Kaufman.
So, big night.
Oh, Andy, have you had dinner?
Yes, I had spaghetti.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Hey, Lauren, I'm getting calls from upstairs. You ordered a llama?
A llama?
Yeah, we all decided it was much funnier than a donkey.
Right, just the guys down at the loading dock were expecting, livestock.
Well, NBC did ask for something fresh and unexpected.
That's true. They also weren't expecting you to demand an overhaul in the entire lighting and sound package.
Did anyone ask Edison what a light bulb was before he harnessed electricity?
Who are you in the metaphor?
The light bulb?
We can't expect people to recognize something they've never seen before.
Right, okay, yes, you're correct. But just, how about a final script?
It's not my kind of show.
Okay, well, what kind of show is it, Lauren? Do you even know what the show is?
Of course.
Are you gonna share it with the rest of us?
Yes. In 88 minutes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, because he'll know by the time that comes up. That's Lorne Michaels.
When it happens, you'll know it.
Yeah. Played by Gabriel Labelle. Cooper Hoffman as the studio executive, Dick Ebersol. Nicholas Brown there, Cara, playing the character, or Andy Kaufman playing the character of Nicholas Brown, but he also plays a second character.
He plays Jim Henson, and God love him, in the middle of all of these crazy comics, most of them are high, a lot of them are cursing, poor Jim Henson is going around with one of his Muppets, and the rest of the comedians are being very mean to his Muppet. I won't tell you what they do to poor Big Bird, but he's just this lovely fella just trying to get his skit done in peace and quiet, and he just wants his Muppets to have some respect.
Stars on this one from you, Cara.
Oh, absolutely. 4 stars. I just thought it was absolutely hilarious. One of the most enjoyable films I've seen in a long time.
And Hilary?
Yeah, it's 4 for me as well. My only reservation would be that it's got a 15A cert, this, and I wonder how many 15-year-olds would know what a Chevy Chase was if you said to them. So you slightly need to know a little bit about what these guys go on to do.
Right, okay.
But it's great. It is just tremendous fun.
That's 3 fours across all 3 films from Hilary White and Cara O'Doherty. The 3 films being Blue Road, The Edna O'Brien Story, Hard Truths from Mike Lee, and Saturday Night, which you've just been talking about. We'll be back with more after this break. Now, let us say Samhain, Bealtaine, Lunasa, and the one that's on top of us, or almost on top of us, Imbolg, are the 4 Indigenous Irish festivals known as the Fire Festivals, which have been celebrated in Ireland for millennia. Next Monday, the second programme of an RTE 4-part series in the Faith Latina, the Fire Festivals, will be broadcast on RTE 1 television, and of course it will be available on the RTE player. The series explores the symbolism and mythology that is central to each of the festivals, their history and evolution, and the impact that these ancient traditions have on Irish culture and identity today. Next Monday's show, the focus is on Brigid's Day, or Imbolg. I'm delighted to be joined in studio this evening by one of the contributors to that particular episode, Dr. Mary Condren, Professor Emerita, Dr. Mary Cardin, I beg your pardon, Mary, Condren, who is the author of The Serpent and the Goddess, Women, Religion and Power in Celtic Ireland, and she is also the director of Women's Spirit Ireland. Maybe we'll get Imbolg for those who haven't heard the term before, although it's become much more popular in recent times, Mary Condren. I can say the name, I promise you.
Imbolg means in the belly. And that's one of the interpretations. But all of the rituals and the material artifacts, the ritual artifacts around Imbolc have to do with regeneration. They have to do with birth. They have to do with regenerating what is already there. And they have to do with nurture. So it's fertility, but not simply, you know, it's not simply about nature. It's also about what we need to do to ourselves to be in alignment with our bodies, with our communities and with the universe.
And Imbolc is, long before Christianity, is associated with the name Bridget, I think, isn't it?
We'd be competent to comment on that, but certainly since the advent of Christianity, Bridget has been associated with it. Now, it's typical of Christian traditions to take over at the old festivals. In fact, Pope Gelasius made a point of saying, you know, take over the old festivals, because that's the only way that you can, get established in new countries. And for that reason, they took over Christmas, they took over Easter, and all of them, of course, were the natural turnings of the year. And that's why they were so successfully taken over.
And what is wonderful about Imbolc or Bridget's Day is that it is now a national holiday. I mean, it has become part of, I suppose, a more secular society. It has become part of a broader society.
Well, you know, we've been in Woman Spirit Ireland, we've been celebrating the Festival of Bridget for over 30 years. And we have made many attempts over the years to persuade dignitaries in Ireland to, you know, accept it and to promote it, and without success. So finally, Leo Varadkar agreed, and all bets are off now. So.
It is referred to as Bridget's Day. That is the title. So can we think of Bridget then as a kind of an all encompassing term for what were female goddesses in the past, in the distant past?
I prefer to talk about female divinities because, you know, many of those female divinities said, don't mention my name, because mentioning the name was automatically to take control of something. So I prefer to be I'm in the cloud of unknowing. And in other words, many years after studying theology, I know less now than I ever did, because I'm still in the cloud of unknowing. But I think the really important thing for us to do today is to start putting flesh on the bones of what Bridget is, because for me, it's not only a tradition of divinity, it also refers to a lineage of female authority. In other words, you know, in ancient times, there's lots of evidence that Ireland was a matri-centred society. Bridget was a peace weaver, even in her lives. She was a poet. She was a smith worker. She was related to healing. In other words, she's a composite figure encompassing all of those ancient
qualities,
divinities.
I suppose if we look at the various symbols attached to her, attached to Bridget, that will certainly put flesh on the bones. The cloak, first of all. Explain that particular aspect of Bridget.
Well, the cloak, again, is an international symbol of female divinity. Sarasvati, Kuan Yin, Bridget, they all had their cloaks. The Kaliak and other related divinities created or shaped the world, going around the world, dropping landscapes or shaping landscapes as they pass them by. So the cloak, effectively, is the womb in many, many cultures around the world. And what I find exciting about the cloak is we put it out on the eve of Imbolc to gather the dew. And when St. Bridget went to collect the veil, she took the Beatitude Mercy. And mercy is also associated with the female divinities around the world. And the dew is the dew of mercy that Sarasvati and Kuan Yin get and pour over their petitioners.
But that cloak being put out the night before the 1st of February, effectively, the idea is, I suppose, that it refers to that connection to nature, which is fundamentally part of all of the fire festivals, you know, because they're at those particular moments of the sun in the sky, in the quarters in terms of the earth. It is interesting that the dew then is brought... It's brought into the house. This is the tradition. The cloak and the dew is brought into the house.
Sure.
It is as much about a link to nature as it is to anything else, isn't it?
It is. And the dew is even found in the Hebrew Bible. You know, when Gideon wanted to ask Yahweh, to make sure that he was going to win the war. You know, Yahweh said, put out that fleece, and if there's dew in it underneath it in the morning, you'll know that I was there. So it's not a specifically Irish tradition, but that's why we need to explore the whole concept of mercy. Like Bishop Budd this week, when Donald Trump was inaugurated, she said to him, ah, for heaven's sake, would you not have mercy? There are many people very scared at the moment. And the concept of mercy, I would think, would be great if it would come in through Bridget and through the female divinities. And I'm thrilled that it was a female bishop who had the courage to stand up to the kind of changes that, you know, certain people like Elon Musk and Zuckerberg and those want to make at the expense of the weak and the impoverished.
And going back to the symbols of Bridget, the other one that, and this is dealt with within the programme, within the film programme itself, the documentary, the power of the belt and how that belt is part of rituals that are carried on, you know, currently probably being going to be carried on over this weekend in various parts of Ireland.
Well, certainly it'll be part of our celebration because, again, the kris is something that we knew very little about when we started our celebrations, but now we understand it. It's a serpent, it's the umbilical cord, and in the medieval times, the monasteries all had the belts of certain saints and they rented them to pregnant women. And so pregnant women put them on to stop miscarriages, to facilitate an easy birth, or even to expel a dead fetus. And this is done, you know, there's lots of evidence about this in the anthropology. So it's, you know, when we started our festivals, I knew nothing about the kris. And there's only one article written in Irish about the kris.
Yeah.
Now we know a great deal more about it, and it's so exciting, you know, to understand these things.
The other thing, I was very struck by one of the several of the contributions, but one that goes into an explanation of the Bridget's cross, the St. Bridget's cross, and making clear that there's a big difference between that and perhaps the cross that many people think, oh, it's a cross that's associated with the Catholic Church or the Protestant Church, for that matter, the Christian Church.
There is a line in one of the lines of Bridget where she takes the cross to a dying man and converts him to Christianity. But there's a lot of appropriation of the ancient indigenous symbols in the lives of St. Bridget. And again, the cross is a universal symbol. It's found in many different cultures. And the exciting thing about Bridget is that she could be a bridge between Irish culture and many other cultures around the world.
And but that's the specific reference to the cross is the fact that the four arms or legs of the cross are exactly the same length. They aren't straight across and straight up and down. They're slightly off kilter, which is all about movement.
Absolutely, because it refers to a cyclical form of regeneration. And that's also to do with the four fires, because you're regenerating the cosmos from one season to the next. And so it is all about movement. And what we've also found in different parts of Ireland, there are different crosses. In other words, different people, immigrants, brought their traditions to Ireland after the Ice Age. And it's fascinating to find all the wealth of the different types of crosses that can be made.
And one of the other things that's mentioned within the programme is this idea that, you know, we have the Mummers and we have the Wren Boys, but we also have the Biddies.
Yes.
Tell us what the Biddies are.
I don't know a great deal about the Biddies. I can tell you a little bit more about the Breedogues, because in the Scottish tradition, according to Alexander Carmichael, the women would take the little Breedog, the little baby Bridget, and bring her into the house and place her in the cradle and put her beside the hearth. So that's the tradition of the Breedog. I don't know a great deal about the Biddies.
There is a section within the film itself where we see the Breedogues, who you could basically do something similar to the Wren Boys and the Mummers. It's a kind of performance, but we will leave that to people. They'll have to go and watch it now to find out exactly what the Biddies are. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for coming into us tonight, Mary. That's Mary Condren. And Na Féile Tine Imbolg will be broadcast on RTE1 and on the RTE Player on Monday, February the 3rd, which is, of course, Bridget's Day, the national holiday. It'll be there at 6:30 p.m. And this Saturday, Women's Spirit Ireland, Mary's group, will host a special celebration of Bridget as Peace Weaver. And that takes place in Ungrain in on in Termonfeckin, and you find out full details on Eventbrite. But that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Cara O'Hare was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. And Ray Cuddihy will be with you after the news.